little bit more break between the lab and the lecture. Today the lecture is pretty light, so you can take it. Now, I probably mentioned to you on Monday that this year what we do, we tape the lecture and then we post the tape on the website. So unfortunately, the first lecture, because I refused to put this microphone around my neck, it didn't come up very well. So they don't have a wireless wireless microphone. They will try to get one, which is my, they were teasing me with my, you know, dreams about like Michael Jackson things. It would be fun. So I will try. I mean, it's hard for me to go with a microphone, my pen. So, but anyway, we'll see how it will work. I don't want to put in the neck because I tend to walk around and I can see disaster coming through. So I'm sorry for the first lecture didn't come up as good. And I'll see if I can teach you with this. I'm just gonna give up. Our first lecture we introduced. Longitudinal, basically we gave an overview and a definition of what is a longitudinal data set, as well as several examples of a longitudinal data set. And so that's basically, I'm just bringing back as a quick review. I think everyone at this point should be very comfortable with this first slide. Univariate statistics is when each subject is measured only once. Multivariate statistics is when you have multiple measurements for each subject, but these are measurements of two different response, different outcomes. So for each subject, we might want to measure blood pressure and body weight, for example. Longitudinal data is different. It's not univariate statistics. It's not multivariate statistics. It's something in the middle. Because of what we do, we have repeated measurements of the same response over time. And so we looked at several examples. So the first lecture, we basically gave a lot of examples of how longitudinal data can arrive. Now, we provide also the motivation why you need to take this class if you need to analyze longitudinal data. Well, because when you have a repeated measurement on the same subject, these measurements will be correlated. And so we need to take into account of that correlation. Sometimes that correlation is scientific interest. Sometimes, even if it's not, whatever estimate we are looking at could be the estimate of a treatment effect of any parameter of a regression model. To probably do the estimation, we need to take into account of the correlation. So when we finished to look at all the data sets, we basically said, well, what these examples have in common? They are repeated observation on each experimental unit. Units can be assumed independent of one another. And so multiple responses can be multiple responses within each unit are likely to be correlated, generally the objective can be formulated as a regression problem, where the purpose is to describe the dependence of the response of an explanatory variable, and the choice of the regression model will depend on the nature of the outcome. So the outcome is continuous. We basically going to generalize the linear regression. If the outcome is binary, we generalize the logistic regression. If the outcome is a count, we generalize the Poisson regression. Now, one important aspect of the longitudinal data, that was the first example that we showed with remember the reading ability. And so this is actually, I think this is a critical point because I just want to quickly show you again the two features for the simple reason that if this is, so remember that, let's assume that you know nothing about that. So if you look at this data set and you look at the relationship between readability and age, you basically you could conclude that there is a negative relationship. But now if you connect, and if you know this is a longitudinal data set, and so you connect the two lines, then you will get to a totally different conclusion. So by looking at this plot, you see you can take advantage of two sorts of information. One is the cross-sectional information, which basically is the red point. So you can look at what is the relationship between age and reading ability at baseline. And that will be your standard linear regression analysis. And you will conclude that by looking at the data at the baseline, as the kids get older, the reading ability is slower. But then, so this is like one approach, which is the standard cross-sectional approach. Now, you can also do the cross-sectional analysis at the second visit. Right? You can do the same thing, and you could probably conclude the same thing as well. Or you can look at the change within each subject, and that's what we call the longitudinal component. So you can really split the total variability in two components, the variability at baseline and the variability within each subject. And that's why, remember, whenever we try to build statistical model, we try to explain variability. And more variability we have, more power we have to understand whatever phenomena we are trying to explore. So, see how long I'm going to keep with this. Okay, so now I was all doing this because I was bringing back. So here is the difference, again, between a cross-sectional study and a longitudinal study. So in the cross-sectional study, you have, this is the first regression model, and anyone should be comfortable that when I show you what is the regression, you will go to the baseline, you will estimate your beta C. So YI1 would be the outcome measure of the first visit, and XI1 would be the age of the first visit, and you just do a cross-sectional analysis on the linear regression and estimate beta C. So beta C represents the difference in average Y across the two subpopulations with this switch difference by one unit in N. That is just a standard. So in your longitudinal, if you have a longitudinal data set, you can run a linear regression at each time point. Right? So you could do a linear regression at the baseline, a linear regression at the first visit, and so on, and just compare X and Y across individuals. But another thing that you can do, that when you have repeated observations, you can extend the model so that you have not only the X at the first visit, but the contrast between the variation of the X with respect to the baseline for the same subject. The Xij minus Xi1 is how older a kid gets with respect to his own baseline age. Okay? And so basically you can get the model 3, which is a different type of regression that you do, because you're going to regress how the change in Y for a particular subject is related to the change in X for the same subject. Okay? And that is the longitudinal. So this is the cross-sectional part. And this is the longitudinal part. And you can actually can take the data set to show you the reading ability, and you can actually do it yourself. Because if you just take the red dot at the baseline, you can run a first regression, and then you take all the difference. So if you take only the dots at the baseline, it's the first regression, and then when we know they are connected, we take the difference between the X and the Y for each kid, and you can regress the two vectors one against each other. And what you will find is that in the second regression, the beta L, the coefficient beta C is negative, and the coefficient beta L is going to be positive. Okay? Is anyone with me with this? So, if you do a linear regression by using as only your data, assuming that the only data that you have at the red point, the slope is negative. And then you can do a second regression where what we're going to do, for each subject, you take the difference between the x and the difference between the y, and that's the one data point, difference between the x, the difference between the y, and then you plot one against each other the difference. And the slope is going to be positive in this data set. So I have to do it. Just guess, you know, just make some numbers and still do it. Okay? So in the cross-sectional analysis, when you have a cross-sectional analysis, the basis is a comparison of individuals with a particular value to x to others with a different value. You know, up to this point, all the regression analysis that you have done, this is what you have done. You have done a cross-sectional analysis. Now, in longitudinal analysis, that's why it can be so powerful, because each person is on our control. So beta L is estimated by comparing a person's response to time point versus the x, you know, versus the change in the x at the time point for the same subject. So you see how the change in y are related to the change in x within the same subject. So the powerful thing is that the second analysis will not be confounded by any variable that has to do with the subject, and it doesn't vary with time. Because you compare the change in X for a subject with respect to the change in Y for the same person. So the fact that the person can be older or younger, male or female, it doesn't matter because you compare, if this person is on control. Okay? We will see a lot of examples about that. So we look at the example where we look at this at the CD4 cells with respect to time. And so suppose that we want to estimate a mean status that is reflected on the CD4 level. In a cross-sectional analysis, the one mean estimate must draw from the data from others to overcome measurement error. Suppose that you have only, for each subject, you have only one measurement with CD4 cell at one particular time. Well, you have to borrow certain information. You're borrowing across subjects, otherwise there's no way to get information. But what we can do with the longitudinal data set I showed you on Monday, we can borrow strain across time for the person of interest as well as across people. Remember, we can estimate the data trajectory for each subject as well as we can estimate the average trajectory for everybody. So if there is a little variability among people, that means that one man estimates can rely on data from the others, as in the cross-sectional case. I mean, everyone is the same, and so we can have just one unique estimate. Now, if there is a larger variability, as in the math study, then we have to rely on others. If there is a larger variability between people, then you know, we might prefer to use just data for that particular person because our population is so heterogeneous that we don't want to learn from a person which is very different to estimate the projection with another person. So there are really two sources of variation. One is the variation of y across time for one subject, because you have the variability of the repeated measurements over time for a particular person, as well as you have the variability of y across people. And so these are basically the two major sources of variation that when you do longitudinal data analysis, you have to take into account. Again, cross-sectional analysis, what we do, we stick to the time point, and we look at the variability at a particular time point. In longitudinal data analysis, you fix the person, and you look at the variability across time. Okay? And so we will see the state of command that when you have a longitudinal data set, simply that you have multiple subjects with repeated measurements over time, how to estimate the variability within, means the variability with respect to time, and the variability between. And that for you is a very important piece of information because you know how well you can estimate your beta C, the coefficient for the cross-sectional, and the beta L. So let's make an example. Let's assume that there is almost no variability between subjects, that everyone is the same at the baseline.
Well, you can't do a cross-sectional analysis. You basically don't have the power, right? Similar, if you have a lot of variability at baseline, but you don't have a variability across time, well, you cannot estimate the longitudinal component, because that's the variance of your outcome is what gives you the power to do the estimated coefficient.
Now, what I have in your transparencies are approaches to LDA, where basically I introduce a marginal model and a random effect model and so on. I'm going to keep this on the side for now because it's a little sidetracked. So I'm going to bring this thing back. And what I'm going to do, I want to take the lecture for today to do exploratory data analysis. So, up at this point, we have a definition of a longitudinal data set and try to separate and distinguish the cross-sectional part from the longitudinal part. And I'm just stressing again this little toy example during the ability, just make sure you know that well, that it's very clear what's going on in the data set, okay? Because if you're very familiar with that particular sample, you understand the source of variability. All the rest can always be reconnected to the little toy example. So now we have a data set, and before we start feeding complex models, we have to explore the data set. We have to look at what the data set. And this is an extremely important part. And there are people that are naturally gifted to do explorative data analysis, the people are less. I mean, it's one of these things that, you know, people like to do what people don't. But it's a very, very important, because remember, never trust the output of a statistical model if you cannot relate the output of the statistical model of something that you can see from the data, okay? Remember, we are smarter than a computer. And if you get a very complex model, you get some estimates, and there is no way you can relate your estimates to some visual component of the data, there is something fishy. You have to, the computer is only going to confirm what you know already, okay? So that means that you have done a very constructive exploratory data analysis. So exploratory analysis is a detective work. So that's how we become the investigator and try to figure out what's going on with our data. Then the confirmatory data analysis, when you run your stuff or the data program, it's just going to wrap it nicely. Okay, and give the p-value and the standard error that we need to calculate the right. But generally, it's a very nice, very important to know what's going on even before you see the model. Okay, so it's important to show as much as of the relevant data as possible, rather than only data summary. Always be as transparent as you can, try to highlight the patterns that are of scientific interest. And what I mean by example 1.1 is our toy example of age reading ability. Always, if you have a data set, try to split the cross-sectional components from the longitudinal component. Okay? And so basically, if you can't see it, don't believe it. Okay? That is the rule of thumb. Okay? If you can't see why this coefficient of your test program is negative from your data set, just don't believe the coefficient. Don't believe your computer, because it's something that is not going right. So what I will do between the lecture and the lab, we're going to give you as much as information as possible of how to plot the data, how to basically do exploratory data analysis. And better you are, you know, it's much better to have so many skills in exploratory data analysis, a little less of all additional optional argument of fastness data, because again, most of the information has to come from the exploratory data. Okay? So there are different ways. There are what we call the spaghetti plot. Well, the spaghetti plot is basically we're going to have our data with the repeated measurements over time, and so we're just going to connect the repeated measurements, and that's how we have spaghetti. There are average and distribution plots, like the box plot. I mean, you know, if you remember the data sets on the epileptic seizures, you know, we show the box plot at each time point. And then there are different ways of exploring the data that can give you insight of the amount of the correlation. So remember, for us, it's critical to know how much correlation there is for the repeated measurement.
And if we can get a good estimate of the amount of the correlation up front, then we know how relevant is going to be, you know, your method for longitudinal analysis. Because if we know very well how to explore the data, and we know how to estimate the correlation, and if the correlation is extremely low, you know that the data, the repeated measurements are almost independent. And so we don't need to worry about too much. So I'm just going to show you different ways of exploring the data, why we make such a plot. So this was our was one of the examples that we look at, which was the you know, we have a group of pigs with 48 pigs that were measured over time. So these are weights in kilograms, and basically 48 pigs have been weighted weekly for several weeks. So what this plot shows in a very, very simple way, it's basically connecting the weight measurements for each pig over time. Okay, that's called spaghetti plot. Okay? So, you know, sounds pretty easy, right? Well, this is a very simple data set. Everyone is measured all the time at the same time point. See, we don't have missing data. But if you start looking at the plot very carefully, there are already many things you can say. Okay? So number one is that all the pigs are gaining weight. There is no one here who's doing a diet or it's not working, right? So everyone, and you can easily estimate a rate here, right? Very simple, right? You can just feed a linear regression model where you regress your weight with respect to time and you feed a linear regression. Now, the reason is what we call tracking. What I mean by tracking is that if a pig, the smallest pig here is still going to be the smallest pig at the end. You don't see much of this side crossing, okay? So basically, there are some inherent characteristics in the pig that if it was born very small, although it's gonna gain weight, it's still gonna weigh, it's still gonna be the lightest pig at the end of the step, and that's how we call it tracking, okay? And finally, you see the variability, the variance at the here. It's smaller than the variance of the end. See that? Yeah. So, see, even with this very, very simple plot, there are a lot of things that you know already. Well, the fact that it is a tracking, the fact that the smallest, you know, the pig which is smallest at the beginning is also going to be smallest at the end, is already telling you that there's going to be some correlation within. There are some characteristics inherent to the pig that make the data correlated, right? And second of all, I mean, well, that's easy to fit. This model is very easy to fit. It's just a linear regression. You're going to regress the weight with respect to time. But then if you're interested to estimate an overall rate of increasing weight, you will have to take into account of this correlation, this tracking. Okay? And you also can see that there is another huge variability between pairs. Okay, but some of the variability between pigs actually change with time. Okay, so the pigs, the variance, so if you calculate the variance of these measurements at this time point, it's smaller than the variance of the measurements here. Okay? So one way to further look at the data is to standardize the data with respect to time. So what this plot shows, so it's the same data set, okay? Time. Now, what I did here, I standardized the data by taking out the mean and dividing by the variance. So this way, it's like we are magnifying the data set so we can better identify the individual profile. So what I did is basically now, what I'm plotting on the y-axis, the y star ij, see on top? So y star ij is yij, which is our measurement. Remember, I is the pig, j is the week, minus y bar j, which is this guy here, is the average of all the measurements at time j. Okay? So for each yij, I subtract the mean of all the weights at that time point. And then I also calculate the variance between all the pigs' measurements at each time point. You still have the index J, remember, I is the unit, J is the time. So at each time point, I calculate the mean of the measurement, and I calculate the variance of the measurement. And then I calculate the standardized variable, Y star IJ, which is a YIJ, my original measurement, minus the mean, divided by actually the standard deviation. You see there is no square there, right? So in fact, my Y star IJ are centered at zero. Right? Their mean is going to be zero by definition, took away the mean. And then the variance is the same because I standardize with respect to the variance. My Sj, we know that j is going to be smaller at the beginning and larger at the end. Remember that we have to start it like that and then it's hard, it's like a cone, right? So why we do that? Because in this way we can better analyze the individual factors. So basically, you can see when, you know, so basically there is some tracking, but actually the tracking is not perfect. So if you focus on this the second one, it's true that there is some ranking, the ranking is preserved, but the ranking is not preserved perfectly, okay? So the correlation is there, but, you know, but it's not one. Now, and the reason why we do that, because we can see the spread of the data set. It's just like what I was writing on the ball, it's like to running a magnifying glass along the overall mean response, which was the previous plot. And because we divided by the variance, we adjust for the magnification corresponding, you know, with respect to the variability that we have in the data. Right? So our magnifying glass is more or less magnified, depends on the variance. Okay? So that is actually the standard way of basically calculating a standardized variance. Okay? Now, we are doing all of these when we... So basically, you know, I'm just showing you two examples. I'm just showing you a way of displaying the response against time. I'm not including any covariates. I'm just assuming now that our data set are the repeated measurements over time. Simplest case possible, right? So I show you the peak, and then I'm going to show you for the CD4 count. So the CD4 cell, it's a little bit more complex, right? So actually, let me show you first the spaghetti plot, okay? So this is the spaghetti plot. Remember, so the data set consists of counts of CD4 cells for something like 460 individuals, and against time. But now, this data set is much more complex. You see also the spaghetti, how messy it is. So why? Well, first of all, the people are not measured at the same time. Second of all, there are, you know, well, yeah, so they, so, you know, these guys, this is the last count we had, the other person wasn't so here. There is a non-linear trend. There is no linearity here. There is a huge variability between subjects. So, if you make a spaghetti plot, you know, what are you going to learn about the data? Well, it's very hard. You know, it's just so, you know, so busy that it's hard to understand what's going on, right? So, well, a simpler way is to basically, you know, and let's assume that our scientific, you know, the question of scientific interest is how, on average, for everybody, how the CD4 cell count changes with time. So we just want to estimate an overall course, an overall mean curve for everybody. So, you see, one way, and I'm sorry, I'm keeping putting this, but it's actually coming later. Just gonna, you know. So, I'm sorry. So, what I was gonna say is that, so if we connect everybody, it's too big. Okay? So then we say, well, maybe we can connect, we can do random sample. And we just can connect the line of a random sample. So, we select five people, and we connect the line for them. Okay, so it's less busy. But this is going to help. Well, Well, let's assume that the random sample is not representative, right? Maybe these five people that we have selected are not representative of what's going on. We don't see the offline value, right? So, sure, it's less busy, but it's still hard. I mean, can you conclude, you know, can you conclude what's the other pattern?
You know, it's complicated. So, the reason why I'm, you see, and this is another way of selecting, that's actually the picture you have on the book. That's another way of selecting a few people at random and connecting the points just for a subset.
The reason why I'm taking all this long, because I want to show you this quick, how to make a spaghetti plot, when the spaghetti plot is so confusing, okay? So, it's clear we don't want to connect everyone. We also don't necessarily want to connect the points only for the random sample, because it might not tell you what's going on, because you might meet someone which is very outlier value, so you just want to have an implied feature.
So, a nice way to account for that is actually to do what we call the ZAP plot. Okay, so I'll tell you what the ZAP plot is, and that is in the next part. So, first of all, what you do, you regress your response variable. So yij is the CD4 cell number, and dij is when the measurement is made, right? So you do just a linear regression. You take out the trend, so you regress to yij with respect to time, and you get your residual, rij. So now each person has a residual at each time point, right, which is your residual from your linear regression and y versus time. So again, with me at this point?
Okay.
Then, what we do, we take, for each subject, gi, remember, I is the subject, you take the median, or the mean, doesn't really matter too much, of the residuals for the different time points. And you get this gi. Okay? So each person, you have the residuals for all the time points, and you take the median of all the residuals. And so now for each person, you have one number, which is the mean or the median of the residuals. You know what I mean? And then what we do, we sort the individuals from the one who has the minimum residuals to the one who has the largest residuals. We rank them. Okay, so you're gonna have the first individual, which is the residual, GI, the minimum among the residuals for everybody. Okay, and then you have the second one and so on. And so you can basically identify the subject with the minimum average residual, subject which the average residual is at the 10th percentile, the subject where the average residual is the, you know, the 50th percentile, and so on. So if you're going to characterize the average residual for the entire distribution, and you take the subject at a different quantile, and then you're going to plot, you're going to connect the dots for the people that are in the different parts of the distribution. And then you plot. I'm going to show you the plot, and then I'll tell you again. So this is the plot. Let's see what the plot, what this plot is saying, okay? So what we did, we calculated the CD4 residual, okay? So the step number one is that we got RIJ, okay? Which is the result of regressing Y on time. Then what we do is that we calculate GI, which is the median of RI1, RIN, it depends how many times it's been measured. So for each subject, suppose you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you're gonna have a measure of this mean residual, right? For each subject, you're gonna have a number. So I'm just making it up. -1, -2, -3, 5, 10. That's, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. So, I'm just assuming I only have 5 people in my data set. It makes it very simple, right? So I have 5 people, and for each person, I have this measure GI, which is the average of their residuals over time. You know what I mean?
And what I get is a minus 1, 2, minus 3, 5, 10. Just make it up. These are 5 values of GI for the 5 and 0. Okay? And then what I'm going to do, I'm going to, these maps are the points connected for the person number 5, because I'm the highest of the fields. And then I'm going to connect the points for the person who has the minimum of the fields. And then I'm going to connect the points for the person who is at the center of the distribution. Okay? So for each person, I'm going to have a distribution of the average residual, and I'm going to select the people that are, the smallest residual, the people that have the largest average residual, and the people that are in the middle, that have median residual. And then I'm going to connect the points for them. So you see, in this way, although you don't connect the points for everybody, you connect the points for enough people that represent the entire variability in the of the course. See, it's a nice trick. Do you like that? Yes. Yes. So you're gonna have, just think about that. You have suppose that you only have 5 people. I know, you with 5 people you're gonna connect everybody. But stay with me. Just we have 5 people, and then say basically this person number 3, has an average residual of minus 3, right? So that means that this is gonna be this guy, the minimum one, and so I'm gonna connect all the dots for this guy. And then I'm going to connect all the dots for this guy, the 10, because it's the maximum. And then I'm going to connect all the dots, for the average of this guy, because it represents the center of the distribution, which it could be the 50%. So basically, you're going to have all of these guys, and you're going to find out the people who are at the minimum, at the 10th percentile, at the 25th percentile, at the 50th percentile, and so on. And basically, just plot 10, just connect the dots for 10 person, but because how you have selected the person, they basically represent the entire variability. Okay? So try to do it. Okay? You have a data set, you have the CD4 cell data set on the website. You have the, and you just take to take a data set, you take the CD4 count versus time, you regress one variable versus the other. You get vector of residuals for each subject. You calculate the median residual for each subject. You rank the subject. You identify the subject who is at the different percentile, and you connect for them. Okay? It's a nice trick. Why? Because you see, it's not as big as before, but it tells you what's going on. You see the variability. And that's one of one other component that we might be interested to explore is, remember, in longitudinal data analysis, we are not only interested in estimating how a response vary with time. But we're also interested to estimate how a response varies with a particular covariate, also in addition to time. So we have our repeated outcome. Here we have the CD4 cell. We have the time where the CD4 cells have been counted. And we have another covariate, which I call CESD score, which is the capacity of the immune response. Okay, so it's a CESD score. So what I'm saying is that, I'm just going to move. So you have YIJ, you have time, and you have XIJ now. Okay? Good point. Thank you. So I was just writing up on top. that I'm not just adding it, I'm adding another variable in all my discussion, okay? So before, I'm just going to look at how yj varies with respect to time. And we can make a spaghetti plot, we can standardize, we can do our big plot. Now I'm adding another component, which is xij. So I have a CD4 cell with varying time, and I also have the SESD4, which is a capacity of immune response, which is also, it's a score that measures the depression of the cells, okay? So let me say it again. We have yij, which is the number of CD4 cells. Tij is when the measurement is made. But also, at the same time, we also measure the depression score. And so basically, we want to know if for someone who has a high depression score, is going to further impact the count of the CD4 cells. And so I want to make a plot to see, considering the longitudinal structure of the data, if there is a relationship between X and Y, which is not due to time. Okay? So I want to know if the depression is associated with CD4 cell count adjusted by time. Okay? And so this plot, which doesn't tell us much, what I plot here are I regress yij with respect to time, and I calculate the residuals, so let me call it lyij, and then I regress xij with respect to time, and I calculate the residuals. Right? So with me? I take the CD4 cells, I regress with respect to time, that's what I mean here, and then I have a residual, and then I take the depression score, I regress with respect to time, and I have a residual, and I plot one against each other, and that's what the dots are. And then what I do, I just see the smooth curve, and I'll tell you in a second how we see the smooth curve, I just smooth the data. Okay? So, see, these are the CESD residuals, the differential score residuals with respect to time, plotted with respect to the CD4 cells number residuals. Okay? So I basically, by calculating the residuals with respect to time, I adjust for time. So I know that the relationship between the depression and CD4 is not due by time, not confounded by time. Okay? And then I plot the residuals one against each other. Yeah.
Any questions?
It's together. It's together. Every time the patient gets in, they do two things. See, the same YIJ. Well, then you cannot make the plot. You cannot assess to these are baseline. You can just say whether there is an association between depression score and CD4 at the baseline, because you don't have the information. So this is actually extremely rich because the fact they have a repeated measurement on the covariate. So you see also, I'm getting there actually. So this part I'm just plotting the two sets of results one against each other. And you know, can you conclude is there a relationship between the CD, the depression score and the CD4 cell? There's not much going on here, like it's flat. Okay? But let's continue to look at the data because why we need to do this? Well, because what you want to know, you are exploring whether there is an association between X and Y. And so you have three variables going on. You have a Y, you have a CD4, depression, and time. You want to know whether if you have a higher depression, your CD4 cell is going to be lower. You want to see if these two variables are associated. But then there is a third variable, which is time,
which is affected for both. So, so time is a confounder. So we calculate the two residuals to take time out of the equation, so adjust for the confounding by time, and then we plot the residuals. Okay? And you know, and that is just, you see, what I'm telling you is just things you will do all the time. I mean, you know, every time you adjust for confounder, that's what you do. And then you plot the data and see if there is any association. Now let's assume now our new data set are only the residuals, and we have depression score and CD4 cells multiple times for each subject. So this is a longitudinal data set, right? So I adjusted before time. And I told you that one thing that we need to do is always to separate out the cross-sectional information from the longitudinal information. And so, as you pointed out, you could do two things here. One is a baseline, the first visit, I'm going to have 600 patients. For each patient, you do know their depression score and the CD4 cell. So I can fit a linear regression for them at baseline. And that is our cross-sectional analysis. I'm just going to compare. You know, and then we compare different people, right? So if for 1 minute change in the depression score, is there a change in the CD4 cell? And that's our cross-sectional analysis. But then we can also do the longitudinal analysis, our beta L, remember? How we do that? We take the difference of the CD4 cell count at the second visit to the CD4 cell count for the same person at the first visit. Then you have the third visit, take the difference between the third visit and the first visit. So you can take all the difference. So I'm showing to you. So let's assume that, so I'm just going back to this one, okay? This is the model I showed you before, right? So YIJ are our CD4 cells. XIJ is the depression score. And both are adjusted for time, okay? So you can have two models, okay? So just translate what we look for the toy example to here. A model where you're going to estimate whether for a unit change in the CD in the depression score is associated with a unit change. You have the depression score measured only at baseline. If you don't have the repeated, this is the only thing you can do. And now we are in much better position because we also have a repeated measurement for depression, right? So there's a second regression that you can make, which is this one. Okay? So then, that means that you can make two plots. The first plot, you plot the CD4 cells versus the CD4 cells versus the depression score at baseline, and that's it. And the second one, you plot for each subject the difference of the CD4 cell with respect to his own baseline. Remember, I fixed the same person with respect to the change of his own CD4 on the depression score. Okay? So, you see, it's pretty cool because I showed you the plot at the beginning, which was the depression score versus CD4 cell. And then what I'm taking the same plot, and I'm splitting it in two plots. One is the cross-sectional plot, and the other one is the longitudinal plot. And the two things can tell you where the information about the association between depression score and CD4 cell is coming from. It's coming because of the variability between subjects, or it's coming from the variability within a subject. So I'll show you the two plots. Here are the two plots. And unfortunately, you see, the toy example was much nicer, right? You can see here. Of course, the association, there is not much going on, but still it's worth it to go through how these plots are made. So,
this plot what it does is plugging the baseline score with respect to the baseline CT4. So just take the data for the first visit, like forget about all the rest. Okay? And the curve is flat, there is nothing going on. But in our reading ability example, this would be negative. Okay? And then the second one is the longitudinal information. Actually, yeah, there is some relationship going on. So there is for each subject now you can calculate the difference and you can plot versus the difference the change over time in the depression score. Okay? In the reading ability example, the one I gave it to you, this slope is going to be positive. Okay? And these two plots are showing two different things. In this, the first plot, we are comparing across individuals. For as one subject change of one unit is the depression score, you know, as we move from one subject to another, with an addition with, you know, with higher depression score, how is going to change the CD4 cell number at baseline? The other plot is on average, how the change, the internal change, with respect to the depression score for one person is related to the change of the CD4 cell with respect to the beta of the same person. Okay, so one is relating baseline value, one is relating changes. Okay? Ooh, a lot of questions. Okay. No, each one has their own time point. I mean, the CD4 and the depression score are measured together, are measured at the same time. For different people, are measured at different times.
In fact, you see that these dots here are scattered all over the place.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. It really depends. Yeah. I mean, here we're capturing what is the change with respect to the baseline. It really depends on, you know, the scientific context, but you can capture the change with respect to the previous visit. So you can make, actually, you can make this plot, you know, for every pair of time. But most of the time, we just try to refer with, you know, baseline is generally our measure with respect we like to control. But no one stops you to do that. So.
Yeah, we have more than two measurements for each people and for more than two time points. Right?
Yeah.
When you can construct the second plot, which time point you use one J?
The time point that has been measured. For each person, we have three data points. We have the time, the xij, and the yij. So actually here time it doesn't play anymore because we're just plotting the difference. Each person, so I'm just plotting the difference in y with respect to the points of the difference next. So there's not time.
But when you calculate the difference, you've got to use the one particular time point for the j.
Yeah, it's every time point. For every time point.
Excuse me. So yeah. Does that mean in the second plot, one person can choose whether one person? Only in the case of
random
is like one.
Yes. So for each person has a lot as many different as many successive bits it has. So if one person had a visit at baseline, so let's assume that we have a baseline, and then it gets 2, 3, 4, and 5. Okay? Well, for each person, I'm gonna have yi2 minus yi1, yi3 minus yi1, yi4 minus yi1, and yi5 minus yi1. And then I'm going to plot this versus xi2 minus xi1, and then xi5 minus xi1. Okay, is everyone clear? And then, I mean, we can connect with the spaghetti plot, I mean, whatever you like. Here, we just see it moving forward. Okay? But you see, why is it important? Because when you plot the difference with respect to their own baseline, again, a person is the asset his own control. So we don't need to worry about all characteristics about the person that doesn't vary with time. It's not going to affect the relationship. Okay. And we will see in many examples actually how powerful this is. Because when we do a study and we do a collection, remember, think about how many variables you measure to characterize the patient. I mean, all the risk factors, I mean, are huge, right? But all of these are going to affect only this plot, only that association, because you compare different people, and so you have to take into account of all the characteristics of the different person. You have to match the person, right? We have to account for age, if they smoke, body mass index, you know, whatever you want. Here you don't, because it's the change with respect to themselves. Okay? And so this analysis is a much closer, what we like to call sometimes, a causal analysis. Right? Think about how big is the literature about causal inference. We're not going to go there. But we are closer, we are getting closer understanding causality, because you look within each person, okay? So, on a lighter scale, one thing that we I want to show you and tell you a little bit about smoothing, okay? So, I'm sorry, just going back to this plot for a second. So, suppose that you have a bunch of points. Actually, finally, I'm going to show you the picture. I'll try to show you in time, and then I always took it away. So now let's go back of simply characterizing. So let's assume that now we are just going back to the original data set, okay? CD4 self number versus time. Forget about the depression for now. Let's go back to these examples. And this brown curve, it's what we call a non-parametric smoother. Okay? It's just an average curve. And I didn't want to fit a linear regression because, you know, it doesn't look like that the change with respect to time is linear. And so this is called Loess smoother. Okay? So I'm just going to give you what is the idea of smoothing. Because another thing that you can always do is just to to characterize overall for the entire population how the CD4 cells change with time. And you don't want to marry the linear regression model, you can do a smoothing. A smoothing is nice because you don't need to specify a parametric relationship between time and response. You don't need to say the relationship is linear, the relationship is quadratic, something, okay? So if I feel a smooth curve, actually there is something interesting going on because it looks like that it's almost flat until the year since zero conversion. And then it kind of declines. It's almost fitting a linear regression. I would probably not identify this kind of pattern. Okay. And these are, again, remember, these are kind of messy data. I mean, everyone is measured different time points and so on. So how I calculate that curve? Okay, so I just want to tell you exactly, as precise as I can, how we do smoothing. Okay, because actually that's just another trick for the statistics that we do all the time, and I just want to tell you how it works. So, instead of going to the slide, I'm just gonna to the definition. I'm just gonna go directly to the picture. Okay. So I'm just telling you manually how you do smoothing. Okay? Let's see if you stay with me. So
on this plot of, these are the same points that you had before. Same data set, okay? Because I'm just telling you how we can smooth the data, okay? So, and a very common way of the smoothing is called kernel smoothing. So what we do? Let's look at this part, okay? And see this point, okay? So I'm focusing on one data point, okay? So what we do, we replace each data point with a smoothed one, okay? How we do this replacement, this substitution, okay? So I focus on this data point here, okay? Then I select the window, and that is arbitrary. We need to pick how large the window is, okay? So I decided this is the window I want to pick. And then identify all the dots that are in the window. So I'm circling them, see? And then I take the average of all these dots, and I replace this point with the average of all the dots. Then what I do, I slide this window to go to the next. So now the window is just slightly moved on the right, okay? And then I see all the points that fall in the window. I take the average, and I replace my second data point with the average of the points that are in the window. Then I keep going, now here I am again. And I do that for every single data point from the left to the right. So now I'm testing you and see if you understood what I'm talking about. Okay. So what's happening? I take this window, okay, and I stretch so that it's large for the entire data set. So I just take the window and I just go large. So how my smooth curve is going to look like? Hello? Okay, I heard one point, then what I heard?
Horizontal line,
then what you're saying behind? You're making some sense. Linear line? What else? Okay, so I heard one little point, a straight line on the linear line. Okay? So let's see who this straight answer is correct. Okay, so let's think again, okay? So I go here. And my window now goes from here to the end, okay? And I average all the points. And I replace this point with the average of all the points. Then I go to the second data point. And what I do the same thing. I average everybody. So the second data point is going to be just next to the other. The third point is going to be the same, and so on, so it's a straight line. It's a straight line centered to the average, the total average of all the data points.
It's not actually a straight line, right?
I mean,
it's a line.
It's a flat line. It's just a horizontal flat line where it will start to the average of all the points. Okay? So let's think again. The first data point, our window is all data set. So you average everybody and you replace the first data point with the average of everybody. Then you go to the second data point and you replace the second data point again with the average of everyone. So it's going to be the same mean. So it's going to be a flat line, horizontal, centered at the average of all the points. And now a second test. Let's assume that my window is, I'm just going to squeeze on the other way, and it's just as narrow as a data point. Okay, so speak up, what do you mean by that? Speak up, what do you mean by that? I'm so confused. What did you say?
Okay, so he said that just connect all this, all the data points. Any other answer? Do you agree? So, then, so that's what it's gonna tell you, that larger is the window, right? So if the maximum window, we have a straight line. If the smallest window, we interpolate, larger the window, more smoothing we do. Right? So now, so this is the character smoothing. Let's tell you, there is nothing more from this. Now, when slightly to different things. Now, what I told you is that I just take a straight average, you know, of all the points in the window. Now, sometimes we calculate a weighted average. Instead of just a standard average, we take a weighted average, where we assign a smaller weight to the point as far from the one that we are in the center of the window. So we take still an average of all these points, but the point are far away get less weight than the average that the point are close. Okay? It's not gonna make a big difference. Now, so this is a kernel smoothing. Now, lowest smoothing, it's another, you know, another slightly more complex thing, which what we do, we still have the window, we see the linear regression in this window, and we calculate the data table.
I mean, the idea is the same. Okay, let's go a little bit one at a time. So the kernel estimation,
okay, so now everyone, you know, we pass the test, right? So we selection of the window at a particular time point, we take the mean of all the values that are in the window, and we slide, so to obtain an estimator of the smooth curve at every time, we slide the window from the extreme left to the extreme right, calculating the average of the points within the window every time. Okay? And then sometimes what we do can be a weighting function that changes smoothly over time and give the weight closer to the observation, we give weight to observation that are closer to T. So this is called a and Gaussian kernel. Okay, so basically it looks like that. So this is going to be the weight function. And so all the points that will be closer, so when we calculate the average of all the points that are in the window, the points that are closer to the center of the window get higher average, higher weight than the points that are farther.
There is a minus here, I'm not sure if you have any or not. So, to see what's going to happen is, these are two different
smoothers, different smoothers, and so, this one, when to make the plot, I use a window which is large. So I have a question. To make this smooth curve, I use a window which is larger or smaller than this one on the black?
Smaller.
Good. Okay.
Excellent. So now, I was telling you the lowest smoother. I'm not going to go to the smoothing spline. I was first telling you the lowest smoother. Same, the same idea. Tell the window the window. Just what, you know, what type of algebra we do within, you know, within the window. And so lowest is basically, again, we center the window at a particular time. And now instead of taking a straight average of the point or a weighted average of the point, we see a linear regression. Okay, you see, you know, statisticians also need to publish, right? So we have always to make an maximum more, right? So now we see the linear regression, I mean, it's actually very fast. Now, so we see the linear regression, actually we see the weight of the least square to the point in the window. Then we calculate the residual. Then we get rid of all of the outliers. And then
basically we replace the object, you know, we replace the data point with a fitted value of the weighted linear regression after we have removed the alpha edge. And the only reason why we do that is because the parametric smoother will be less sensitive to outlying values. Okay? So I'll show you why this could be important. So this is the done. So this is the same data set, but now I'm cheating a little bit. I put two extra data points here. Okay, these are two outliers. There are two people that at the end have received a very large number of CD4. Okay? And these ones, the black curve is a kernel smoother. The dotted curve is a low axis smoother. You see, they are similar most of the time. Well, this always has to be higher, but they are quite different to the hand. Why? Well, this is why. In the kernel smoother, I'm here, I have my window, right? So when I replace this point, I calculate the average with respect to this guy. So the average gets pulled up. But if I do less, here I'm feeding a linear regression, I calculate the residual, I get rid of the outline of the residual, and so it's less than 3.5. So if you have a crazy data set without flyer, you want to do a low axis because it's just going to be, you're not going to have some wild behavior because some of these average can be totally driven by one data point. Okay? Remember, you're doing smoothing to characterize an average pattern. Okay? Excellent. Now, in the last 5 minutes, I'm just going to tell you what is the autocorrelation, and then I'll let you go and then we'll start again on Monday. So, what we did, we looked at spaghetti plots, we looked at how to calculate the residual, we looked how to make plots that decompose cross-sectional information from the longitudinal information, and we looked at how to do smoothing. Right? All of these techniques can tell you how to characterize the variability response with respect to time, how to separate the cross-sectional information from the longitudinal information, how to make a plot where you have a lot of subjects and you basically that was a dot plot that you can want to characterize the behavior. And again, how to basically plot and contrast the longitudinal information from the cross-section. What they haven't told you anything yet is how to make a plot that tells you the amount of this correlation between, correlation within. So we have repeated measurements. How correlated are the repeated measurements for the subject? Okay? And I want to anticipate that that's a very important thing for us to know. So how we do that? We calculate the autocorrelation function. So now the autocorrelation function is something which will be with you all for the entire course, okay? You always, when you have a longitudinal data set, you have to calculate the autocorrelation function. Now, you calculate the autocorrelation function, well, most of the time you calculate the autocorrelation function when when everyone is measured at the same number of times. Okay? When you have visit one, everyone is measured. Visit two, everyone is measured. Visit three, everyone is measured. It's not that someone is measured for 0, 1, and 2, somebody else is 1.2, 2.3, and so on. Okay? Everyone is measured together. Now, we cheat sometimes. So now I'm cheating once again because what I'm doing, sometimes you can round it. So the CD4 cell, you know, it's not true. I mean, people are measured at different time points, but we kind of force them to be measured at the same time point. Okay, just to show you that. So, right, so basically the terminology when everyone is measured at the same time point, we say that people are regularly spaced. When other times you have irregularly spaced space data.
So how you you explore the correlation? Well, again, the first thing, you calculate your residuals. Now, this variable x here, I mean time, okay? So you have these,
repeat the measurement. So again, CD4 cells, you have y, which is the number of CD4 counts, and x is the time. So you calculate the residuals, you fill in a regression and calculate your residuals. So now you have your residuals Fij. Okay? And so now everyone will have, it's exactly as we were talking here. Oh boy, this is nice. Yeah, but it's highly toxic. It's I can't even see what's in that spray. Okay, talking about school of public health. No, thank you. So every subject will have, so remember the time points are minus 1. Yes. Okay. Let's see if I can get this right. Are minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2, and 3. Okay. So this was the CD4 cell. These are the time points. Okay. I'm just going to show you again. See the example? You see? Some people are measuring minus 2, minus 1, 0, 2, and 4. Now, different people are measuring different time points. But now I'm cheating. I'm forcing the data set. I'm just going to move people around. So everyone is measured at minus 2. Everyone is measured at minus 1 and 4. Okay? So then with me, I'm just going to reorganize the data set a little bit. Okay? So then what I have, I'm going to have, for each subject, I'm going to have a residual at times minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2, and 3. Okay? Each subject will have 5 residuals, similar as the outcome, right? And so what I'm going to do, I can make what is called the scatter plot matrix. So not panic. What is this? This red box are Ri minus 2 versus Ri minus 1. So the box there, I plus the residual at time minus 2 versus all the residuals at time minus 1. Why this is important? Because I can get information about the lab one. How close to each other are the measures when there is only 1 year difference? The red boxes, now this box here, I'm plotting the residuals at time 0 versus the residuals at time minus 1. Why are you the same color? Does anyone know why I use the same color? Right, correct. It's still a difference of lag 1. All the red box are all the red box are telling me what is the association between the residuals when they are only 1 year apart. Can you guys see that? See this box here, I'm plotting the residual at time 3 versus the residuals at time 4. These are the residuals at time 3 minus the residuals at time 2. These are the residuals at time 1 versus the residuals at time 2. All of these residuals, and each point is a person, right? Are all providing me information about the correlation between the measurements that are 1 year apart. Now, the orange box, this is the residual at time zero, the rest of the residuals at time minus two. This one is the residual at time one versus all the residuals at time minus one. Residuals at time two minus the residuals at time versus the residuals at time zero. So all the orange boxes are telling you the correlation between the measurements that are 2 years apart. And the yellow, the correlation between the measurements that are 3 years apart. So what you expect in general, you see, if you compare, so let's look at the red, the orange, the yellow here, okay? You see that the correlation is higher when we are all in one time apart. And the kind of the correlation diminish when we have the 2 years apart and 3 years apart. Okay? So if we take the correlation of all the red boxes and we average out, that is the correlation of log one. If we take the correlation of all the orange boxes, that's the correlation of log two. The correlation of the yellow boxes are the correlation log three. And then from there, we calculate the alpha correlation function. Okay? So I'm just gonna leave it like that. And then on Monday, we will start from the alpha correlation function, and then we move to the next topic. Okay?